From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Well, here's the setup for the story today. In the summer of 1835, Mormon founder Joseph Smith bought four Egyptian mummies from a man who had been traveling the country, charging two bits to see them. Smith paid a lot for the mummies, but really he was interested in the parchment, the papyrus that came with the bodies. He believed they contained the ancient writings of the biblical prophets Abraham and Joseph. We heard about the story a few months ago when we were talking to the mummy researcher S.J. Wolfe, and we wanted to know more. S.J. Wolfe is joining us today to tell the story, which began several thousand years ago, has all of the elements of a Greek tragedy, and includes a cast, she says, that would be the envy of any soap opera. Have we got your attention? Then join us after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we are telling a story. It's a strange and remarkable story that we learned about a few months ago when we were talking to the researcher S.J. Wolfe. Wolfe is a mummy expert, and in a conversation about the mummy exhibit at the Leonardo, the story of the Joseph Smith mummies came up. Here are the basics. In the summer of 1835, Mormon founder Joseph Smith bought four Egyptian mummies from a traveling entrepreneur. He was less interested in the mummies themselves as the parchments that came with them. Smith believed they contained the ancient writings of the biblical prophets Abraham and Joseph. These were writings he eventually translated that revealed important aspects of the Mormon cosmology about pre-earth existence, about the creation, about a so-called plan for salvation. All of this is a good story, and S.J. Wolfe is joining us to take us through it today. She says it's a tale of adventure, intrigue, of body snatching, desecration, bravado, and sheer chutzpah. We invite you to join us, if you like, with comments or questions. 801-585-WEST is the number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. S.J. Wolfe is senior cataloger at the American Antiquarian Society in Worcester, Massachusetts. She's created a database of all known Egyptian mummies in North America. She's the author of the book Mummies in 19th Century America. And she's joining us today from a studio in Watertown, Massachusetts. And S.J. Wolfe, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me back.
I should mention Mummies of the World closes at the end of the month at the Leonardo in downtown Salt Lake City. So S.J. Wolfe, let me start. It's a pretty, as I said, it's a really fascinating, strange story. Where did you come across this particular story?
Well, I came across it basically because I was trying to find all of the mummies that had come into America before 1900. And it just happened that H. Donald Peterson had written a book called The Story of the Book of Abraham. And there was a whole chapter on the early Egyptian mummies, and I realized that he had some of the details wrong.
I wonder if most mainstream Mormons know this story. And we should point out that Smith included his version of it in the official history of the church.
Oh, yes. Most modern-day Mormons are very much aware of the mummies because there's current research going on to find other mummies associated with the cache to see if there are any more papyri.
Right. The way Smith tells the story, and this is sort of the story that comes originally, and that the idea that these mummies and these records were obtained from this catacomb in Egypt near the city of Thebes by the celebrated French traveler, and we're going to work through all of this, that there were some 11 mummies at first, and this particular traveler wills this to his nephew. As Smith tells it, at some point, the collection makes its way to Kirtland in the summer of 1835. How much of that story did Joseph Smith actually get right, the way he tells it?
Not a lot. He took his story from what Chandler told him.
Right.
But if you go back and look at some of the historical aspects, Michael Chandler was an Irish tradesman who had emigrated to the United States. Antoine Laboulo, who is the man who found the mummies, was a very celebrated archaeologist in his time, and trying to find a relationship between those two men was very difficult to prove. There's no proof that Chandler was Lobolo's nephew. The basic truth is that 11 mummies arrived in New York City, and by 1835, Chandler had them.
Yeah.
We're not even sure Chandler retrieved them from New York because his name doesn't appear on any of the exhibition notices or anything until he shows up in Hudson, Ohio.
Right. I want to really break down that story, but I wanted to get this out of the way. There are elements of the story that we should say contradict and challenge some basic elements of the LDS story and LDS doctrine. I mean, in particular, what the papyrus were actually revealed to be and to actually say. I mean, Smith believed them to be the ancient writings of what he called, you know, the fathers Abraham and Joseph, and his translation revealed to him this, you know, cosmology, as I mentioned, of the pre-earth existence and this plan of salvation, as Mormons call it. You don't really deal with that part of the story in your book, that theology part. So how much of that do we want to get out of the way?
I really didn't get into it because I'm not Mormon, and I didn't want to sort of step on anybody's religious toes. The one thing that I can say is the surviving fragments of papyrus that we know were part of the original papyrus are not the story of the Book of Abraham. They're fragments from one of the many books of the dead. There's a number of them that were often buried with mummies. And one particular papyrus is what's called a hippocampus. It's a spell, a magical spell, that's placed under the head of the deceased.
All right, let's talk about Antonio Laboulo. Fascinating guy. In the 1820s, he, as you say in your book, he lives in Egypt. He's excavating, I guess, if you can call it that. Lives in this small cave, carves his name on a pillar there. What do we know about him? Because you describe him as having led a pretty flamboyant lifestyle.
Well, he worked on and off in Egypt as an excavator. This was a time of freebooting, looting. Anybody who wanted to could go and dig. You didn't need permission. He excavated several caches of mummies. One cache wound up in the Turin Museum, and one cache wound up in a German museum. And he had a very fierce rival, Chevalier Drovetti, who was also trying to get mummies for his patron, Henry Salt. So there was kind of a friendly rivalry going on. He had business ventures back home selling Egyptian antiquities. This was a big deal in Europe.
Yeah.
And supposedly he found the 11 mummies and he was returning to his home when he died.
He dies 1829, and eventually these 11 mummies end up in Michael Chandler's hands, though he isn't Lobolo's nephew. That seems to be a story someone tells. And you mentioned Michael Chandler, an immigrant Irish farmer. However it plays out, it seems that Mr. Chandler needs some money. So he leaves his job, you say, leaves his family to go about showing the mummies and the papyrus for profit. And from time to time, as he's going along, he would sell a mummy or two. How often did this kind of thing happen, people traveling the country showing these exotic things?
Well, the early mummies, the ones that came in 23, 24, 26, and some in 29, they were traveled all over the country. We have one particular mummy that we know came in 1826, and he traveled everywhere from upstate New York all the way down into Massachusetts, up and down the Connecticut River. And the river systems. And I think I documented 50 or 60 places he was exhibited.
Wow. So Chandler travels around, shows the mummies, and I guess wherever they go, they get attention. There are these articles in newspapers you print in your book about the collection, Baltimore and Pittsburgh. And in Philadelphia, there's an advertisement from a Philadelphia paper. This is April of 1833. It says the largest collection of Egyptian mummies ever exhibited, found in the vicinity of Thebes. And it says, will afford much satisfaction to amateurs of antiquities. Admittance, 25 cents. Children, half price. So wherever they went, I guess they got some attention.
That's true. There were so few mummies being exhibited in America that they were a showstopper. If you wanted to get people to come to your museum or whatever, you got an Egyptian mummy. Nobody had ever had more than two, maybe three. 11 was just out of this world.
Hmm. I loved this article from a newspaper in Baltimore that you include in your book, how these six strangers, illustrious from their antiquity, an existence of at least 1,000 years anterior to the advent of our blessed Savior, and contemporaries of the first sovereigns, David and Saul. It seems like this was part of the appeal, right, S.J. Wolf? This connection to familiar biblical figures, to the biblical past.
Well, yes, that was primarily how mummies were perceived at this time. Probably the two books that any household at the time had were an almanac and a Bible. And everyone knew the story of Joseph and the sojourn in Egypt. Everyone knew the story of Moses being rescued by the Pharaoh's daughter and his rise to power and then the Exodus. So exhibiting these mummies was a tangible link that the common man could find to this history that they knew from the Bible.
Mm. What was Chandler's exhibit like? Would people, you mentioned, I guess I'm imagining them just sort of walking past them. You say that Chandler had exhibited this kind of, this patter that he would use. I mean, there was some information available, and I guess he read up on it, so he sounded like he knew what he was talking about, I suppose.
We don't really know. There's no extant descriptions of the exhibit of the mummies. We assume that we know they came in coffins, but what kind of coffins, I don't know. They could have been plain wooden boxes, or they could have been what we think of as mummy coffins, the mummiform, the human thing.
Mm-hmm.
They were probably exhibited standing upright with the coffin lid to one side, probably roped off, although in later times Chandler did allow people to touch the mummies and handle the papyrus. I'm sure he stood there and said, well, these are mummies from ancient Egypt. He did know about the various kinds of mummification. These were of a very high order, so I'm sure he told them that. And he probably sprinkled in a little bit of Bible history. Well, you know, they were alive during the time of Moses or during the time of Abraham. But it wasn't ever written down, so we don't know exactly. But he was referred to as a learned person.
How does it make you feel when you think about how Chandler and others may have treated these valuable relics? I mean, he went through them looking for valuables. I guess he unwrapped their heads to make it look more, maybe more grisly or more interesting. I mean, do you worry about the real story there, their value as artifacts, and whether or not that particular part is kind of something that's lost to us now?
It's an interesting question, because now we would be horrified to think that anyone would do this. But that was the state of archaeology and of Egyptological research. You were looking for plunder. You were looking for the jewels. You were looking for anything that was on the body. Even the Egyptians themselves had no compunction with selling these bodies off. That was how they treated them. They were curiosities. You examined them.
So you just have to, so S.J. Wolfe, you just have to get over that fact that that's just the way it was, I guess.
Yes, and it's really hard for modern archaeologists to look at that and they go, oh my God, all the information that was lost. Well, it was.
Yeah, yeah. Let's talk about the papyrus in this collection. So there were rolls in two of the mummy coffins, I guess. Is that right?
Well, two or three. We're not really sure.
Right.
We know that when Chandler claimed he opened one in New York, that he found some kind of roll in the wrappings. Now, when he sold two of the mummies to Junius Brutus Booth, the actor, Booth recorded in his memoirs that he had purchased the two mummies who had been represented as priests of the god Apis, and they were accompanied by rolls of papyrus which were indecipherable. So we know that he had papyrus rolls, but we don't know how many. Mm-hmm. At least two of the mummies had papyrus rolls with them.
I love this Booth connection to the story. It's kind of an intriguing element. I mean, so the mummies are in the area of Ohio and Kentucky. This is winter of 1833, I think it is. And Junius Brutus Booth, as you say, purchases two of them. He, of course, is the father of Lincoln's assassin, John Wilkes Booth.
Correct. And he was a very, very famous actor. His original intent, he was looking for a gift to give to Andrew Jackson. And he thought that these were such curious oddities that he would buy them and present them to Jackson, who was living at the Hermitage. Mm. His daughter said, no, these are very valuable artifacts. You should probably give them to John Varden, who was starting a museum of natural history in Washington, D.C. That would go through several iterations and wind up being the Smithsonian.
So Michael Chandler is going around the country, showing these mummies, selling them, some of them as he goes, a couple to Booth, apparently here. A Samuel Morton apparently purchased two of them as well for this this collection of skulls that he had. And I guess they ended up at the Academy of Natural Sciences or something?
Yes. Morton was a very early anthropologist. And the study of anthropology at that time was based on polygenesis, that the different races of men had sprung from different ancestors. As racist as this sounds, and there's no way that I can make it sound less racist, Morton and his contemporaries were trying to prove that the ancient Egyptians could not have been Negroid or black. So he measured the cranial capacity of thousands of skulls of Egyptian mummies. He wrote a book on it called Crania Egyptiaca. And the only known depiction of any of the mummies from the Chandler collection is on plate 10, and I believe it's illustration number 30, of the head of one of the mummies.
So of that, we'll get to this as we go, of that collection, that original collection that Michael Chandler has, what's left?
Well, we know there were two heads in Morton's collection that went to, his whole collection eventually went to the Academy of Natural Sciences, which eventually went to University of Pennsylvania. The body of one of them went to the American Philosophical Society, and there may or may not be one of the mummies through a very long, convoluted, and not at all provable process that wound up at the Niagara Falls Museum and was purchased by the Carlos Museum at Emory University.
S.J. Wolfe is with us. She's the author of the book Mummies in 19th Century America. The Mummies of the World exhibit is on display at the Leonardo in downtown Salt Lake City. Closes May 27th. Starting tomorrow, they're offering extended hours. You can get details for that on our website, radiowest.keur.org. You can join us at 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@keur.org. We'll take a brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about the story of the four mummies purchased by Mormon founder Joseph Smith in 1835. Smith was interested in the parchment that came along with those desiccated bodies. The researcher S.J. Wolfe is with us. She's more interested in the bodies themselves and the exhibits that traveled around the country at the time. Her book is called Mummies in 19th Century America, and she's joining us from a studio in Watertown, Massachusetts. You can join us, 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. So this is the part of the story that brings us to Joseph Smith, and I guess we should say that Michael Chandler, who has these 11 mummies initially, there were reports that he was told in New York when he first came upon the mummies that that the Mormon prophet Joseph Smith could may be able to help him reading this ancient writing that he found in these papyri.
That's true. George Zaferth, he went to first, was an expert in hieroglyphs. He was an expert in ancient languages. And Zaferth could not read the papyri, which leads us to possibly believe that they were written in hieratic or demotic, which were derivative alphabets from the hieroglyphs. Zaferth knew that Joseph Smith had translated the golden plates that created the Book of Mormon, and Smith himself told people that they had been written in Reformed Egyptian.
Right.
And so Zaferth told Chandler that Smith was probably the only person who could tell him what the papyrus were.
So I guess, but he takes his time getting to Joseph Smith. He's in no hurry to get there, but he does make his way there finally, in the summer of 1835. And I guess the condition of the exhibit, it's pretty small at this point. It seems like it's in pretty bad shape. I mean, there were four mummies left. You say in your book, for all intents and purposes, they were close to being naked, the figures.
They had been opened, unwrapped. There's very good descriptions of the bodies in a couple of the newspaper accounts, although they're not always sure if it's three females and one male or one male and three females. The wrappings were loose. They were probably no longer in their mummiform coffins. I don't find any reference anywhere to that they're in anything other at this point than plain wooden boxes.
Hmm. So Chandler, you say, checks into this hotel there in Kirtland, Ohio, and he's preparing to exhibit the mummies, I guess. But first he meets with Joseph Smith. I guess it's fair to say Chandler wasn't all that, I don't know if I should put it this way, but this doesn't seem like it was all that truthful with Joseph Smith as to the origins of the mummies. For example, you say it was pretty common for mummy sellers to exaggerate the stories of these mummies.
Yes, it was. Princesses, priestesses, they're very exotic. That's a lot more fun for people to look at than, someone who is a weaver or a stonemason. We don't know exactly what Chandler told Smith, only that the mummies were ancient. Now, Smith was the one who looked at the papyrus and who said that he felt these were contemporary bodies with Abraham and Joseph. Hmm. Newspaper accounts say that he said he had the bodies of Abraham, Joseph, and Abimelech. Now, it's a lot of hearsay.
Yeah.
It's very hard in this whole story to separate fact from fiction or fact from misunderstanding.
But we should mention, early church leaders, Orson Pratt among them, said Smith was very, very anxious to obtain the papyrus. He thought this was very important.
Yes, he was convinced that these were the writings of Abraham and Joseph. And so he offered to buy them from Chandler. At this point, I think Chandler was a little tired of hauling these bodies around, and he refused to sell just the papyrus. He said he told Smith he would have to take the bodies as well. And so Smith and the townspeople raised the then pretty incredible sum of $2,400 to buy the four mummies and the papyrus. So Smith felt they were, the papyrus were extremely valuable.
Yeah. How much were they really worth? I mean, they had been, you had said earlier in the the book that they had been valued at between $200 and $300, or at one point they were mentioned as being worth about $450 a piece. But, I mean, $2,400, that's a lot of money, something like $60,000 in today's money.
Yes, it is. The value depended on their being rare.
Yeah.
That there weren't any others. And there certainly weren't any this far west by the time Chandler gets out to Ohio.
You point out the early Mormons were building their first temple at this point. They didn't really have the money. And I guess there are conflicting stories about how they came up with the money to buy these mummies.
Correct. There's a man named Coe, C-O-E, who claimed to have lent Smith a large amount of the $2,400. Other records indicate that the faithful chipped in and the townspeople chipped in to buy the mummies. In any case, he paid $2,400 to get them.
Yeah. Did he get taken? I guess is the question that came to me.
I don't think so.
Really?
Considering what mummies were worth at the time, he went on to exhibit them at 25 cents a head. I don't know how much money he made, but I'm pretty certain that almost every Mormon who could go to see them and the papyrus did. We have so many letters and diary references to faithful Mormons going to visit the bodies and visit the papyrus. And then other people, too, who are interested because Smith was translating this papyrus and it excited interest in the non-Mormon community.
And why, do you think?
Well, how would you feel if someone suddenly dug up George Washington and put him on display? He's a visible link to American history.
Right.
If you had writings that were never known that George Washington had that were suddenly available, they would be interesting to you. Because of the biblical connection, these things were just, people were just absolutely fascinated with them.
Mm.
And the Mormon faithful even more so because of the validation that these papyrus that Smith translated appeared to give to their religion.
Right. You mentioned one letter where an apostle was apparently sent out or something to exhibit the mummies, but that venture turned out not to work so well?
That was Coe.
Yeah.
He claimed he had the right to exhibit them because he had paid so much money. And I don't remember offhand the amount, but I think it was $500 or $600, which for a private fortune was a lot of money.
You write that by August of 1836, the papyrus had been moved to Smith's translating room. I guess this is a room on the top floor of the Kirtland Temple. And you also write the mummies ended up there, too. They're in the temple.
Yes, that was a very convenient place to display them. People were visiting the temple, and so they could come in and look at the mummies and visit the temple. I don't know how many people he allowed into the translating room, but we do know that a lot of people handled the papyrus.
Mm.
There's a lot of notes that say he was very willing to have people handle the papyrus and look at it.
You mentioned that as things start to turn bad for the early Mormons there in Kirtland, a mob threatens to take the mummies and the papyri and to burn them. And I guess Lucy Mack Smith, Joseph Smith's mother, turns out to be one who helps keep them safe for a while.
Yes, they are moved into her house, and they're under her protection, and she continues to exhibit them at 25 cents a head.
So they disappear for a while. There's this kind of period between Kirtland and Illinois where the Mormons are shifting around, moving around. And we don't know where they are, these mummies, I guess, for a year or two. I mean, they were as much on the run, you say, as the Mormons were themselves.
Yes. There are, again, conflicting stories as to what happened to them. One story has Joe Smith's brother, William, taking them and exhibiting them and selling them in Missouri to the Chicago Museum that burned in 1871. That's kind of been discredited because the Chicago Museum wasn't even in existence at that time. Lucy Mack Smith probably had them, but as the Mormons were being pursued and persecuted, it's not unlikely that these very, very valuable relics, including the papyrus, were shared around among the faithful and kind of kept hidden so that they wouldn't get destroyed.
How is it that you mentioned that I'm trying to square this idea of them being rare with the other stories that I've heard about? I think you've talked about this too, is that that there was a time in American history when the wrappings from mummies from Egypt and I guess in other places were actually brought here, shredded up and used for paper.
Right. That happened the first paper that we know of, or the first wrapping shipment, was in 1853 in New York. 53, 54, 55, this was the beginning of it, and it went on through the 1900s. It was the brainchild of a man who was searching to help America find a source for rags for making paper. His name was Isaiah Deck, and he was a chemist. And once he had published his thesis in the paper and then in New York in 1854, the idea was just fantastic. And millions of tons of mummy wrappings were imported and used in the paper mills.
Mm. I think I've asked you this before, but how does that make you feel?
It's a little weird. It's even a little more weird because I own several items that I know were made from paper made from mummy wrappings. But it was not, again, it was the time. The Egyptians themselves had no respect for the mummies whatsoever. And so if they could make money off them, they were perfectly willing to strip the wrappings and put them into the international rag trade, and then they ground up the bodies for fertilizer, primarily for English rose gardens.
Mm. S.J. Wolfe is with us. She's the author of the book Mummies in 19th Century America. The Mummies of the World exhibit is on display at the Leonardo in downtown Salt Lake City. Closes on May 27th. Starting tomorrow, they're offering extended hours, by the way. You can get details for that on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. So we're going to take another break. Back in a moment, you're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio, back now with researcher S.J. Wolfe. She's the author of the book Mummies in 19th Century America. We're talking about a story that we learned about a few months ago when we were talking with S.J. Wolfe, the story of Joseph Smith, the founder of the Mormon religion, and when he purchased in 1835 four mummies from a traveling entrepreneur. She's joining us from a studio in Watertown, Massachusetts. I wanted to ask you about, so we mentioned how the mummies eventually end up in Nauvoo, Illinois, displayed in a number of places. First on the second floor of Joseph Smith's cabin there, like I guess like in the attic or something?
Yes. One of the letters that we have talks about them being displayed in the attic, and the only way up was a very steep ladder that was either leaning against the side of the wall or up the wall. And you climbed up it, and they were displayed in wooden cases, and he had draped their lower extremities in some kind of fabric.
The part of the story that I think is quite interesting is Nauvoo, 1841. And at some point, I guess Lucy Mack Smith becomes kind of the curator of the exhibit, I suppose, the one who would tell the story of those who came by. And I wanted to read this account that you include in your book. It's an account by a young girl named Charlotte Haven. She went to see the mummies at the Smiths. This is February of 1843. She says, Madam Smith's residence is a log house very near her son's. She opened the door and received us cordially. She is a motherly kind of woman of about 60 years. She receives a little pittance by exhibiting the mummies to strangers. When we asked to see them, she lit a candle and conducted us up a short stairway to a low, dark room under the roof. On one side were standing half a dozen mummies, to whom she introduced us as King Onidas and his royal household. This is the odd part, SG. Well, she took up what seemed to be a club wrapped in a dark cloth and said, "This is the leg of Pharaoh's daughter, the one who saved Moses." That's such a strange story and in such an interesting way of telling it. It's almost like she's kind of made up a story to make this exhibit all the more intriguing and interesting.
That was a very common practice. The leg of Pharaoh's daughter would have been familiar to everybody.
Yeah.
Where King Onidas comes in, I don't really know. At one point, Joseph Smith says that they're King Onidas and his daughter Katumin. Now, I have a little problem with some of that because ancient Egyptian was written without any internal vowels. Vowels could start words, but they couldn't be in the middle. They used only consonants. Where he got these names is never been made clear. But he clearly thought that the male was royal, and then the women were either his wives or members of his household.
Doesn't he give one of them the name Pharaoh Necho or something, king of Egypt or something?
At one point, he calls one Pharaoh Necho. Necho is one of the two Egyptian pharaohs who's actually mentioned in the Bible. The other one is Sheshonq, in a different form of the name. But those were actual personages in the Bible. And so, again, they would have been familiar to anyone who read the Bible.
Mm. You say that Josiah Quincy, man who would become fairly well-known and eventually becomes the mayor of Boston, he visited Nauvoo and went to see Joseph Smith, who showed him these mummies. Tell about that story, if you would.
They were just sort of on display. And he said I think this is the story. I think this is the one where he calls that little runt of a fellow there. He was a great pharaoh of Egypt. And I don't really know how much Quincy believed him.
Yeah.
Because Quincy's own account of it is a little bit on the humorous side. So I don't know how seriously they took Joseph Smith and his claims about the mummies.
He notes, this is sort of the clincher of the story, he does note on his way out, Josiah Quincy does, probably not with just with more than a little irony, that Smith told the people that those who see the mummies pay my mother 25 cents. Right? I mean,
yeah. He played up the fact that his mother was a poor widow and gentlemen usually paid to see the mummies.
How much do you figure people were they making, the Smiths, on this exhibit? I mean, was it a moneymaker? Do you have any sense of that?
I don't really have a sense of it, but it wasn't costing them anything to exhibit them. So 25 cents a head, I mean, you'd have to do the math how many hundreds of people would have to come in to get $2,400 worth of money. I really doubt that they made back the $2,400. That's an awful lot of money at 25 cents a head.
Yeah. I wanted to go back to this act of translation that Joseph Smith does. Again, we don't need to get into the theology necessarily, but I do want to ask, why are these papyri, why are they so important, do you think, to Joseph Smith? I mean, why are they important to his concept of his cosmology of his church, the mysteries that he's thinking about? Do we know?
I personally don't know. I think the best book on the subject would be H. Donald Peterson's The Story of the Book of Abraham. It would talk about the cosmology and the relationship and why these were so important. Not being Mormon, I think I would be uncomfortable trying to guess at what Smith was trying to get at.
Yeah.
I know he desperately wanted a solid foundation for his religion, and the more that he could bolster it, the happier he was.
So Joseph Smith is killed in 1844. What happens to his mummies?
His mother takes them. They stay in her possession until she dies, and then her heirs sell them. Now, by that time, the son is breaking away from the church, which is being led by Brigham Young, and Joseph Smith III is starting what would eventually become the reorganized Church of Latter-day Saints.
Right. And they make their way eventually to a museum, I guess?
Sold to a man. After Lucy Mack Smith dies, her heirs sell the mummies and papyrus. Now, I don't know why. They may have needed money. They may have not thought that they were that important. We don't know why. They were sold to a man named Abel Combs, or Coombs. He probably was Mormon. They don't, again, have any proof either way, but he sold two of them to Wyman St. Louis Museum. They stayed there where they were authenticated by Mormon elders, and they were exhibited with the papyrus. It was a man and a woman who were exhibited. Mm. That museum was eventually bought for the city of Chicago and became Colonel Wood's Museum and Theater, was destroyed by fire completely in the Great Chicago Fire of 1871.
And so I think at that point it is that we figured this is the end of that story, that this is where they ended up. They were burned. They've been destroyed. But then the story turns again in 1967. You report the LDS Church acquires 11 pieces of papyrus from, I think it's the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York.
Yes, it is. Only, remember, they only sold two of the mummies. So someone, probably Abel Combs, still has the other two mummies. There's no record that either the church people or I have been able to find that Combs ever sold the mummies elsewhere. So when Combs moves to Philadelphia, just about the same time that Wood, whose museum's just been destroyed, moves to Philadelphia. Wood moves in 72, and in 1878, he sells four mummies to the Niagara Falls Museum. At this time, Combs is living in Philadelphia. He's listed as a lamp maker, and through the idea of things being coincidental, it's quite possible that Combs sold the two mummies to Wood. He had in his possession these fragments of papyrus. Mm-hmm. When he died, they went to his housekeeper. His housekeeper's heirs gave them to the Metropolitan Museum of Art, where they were rediscovered in, as you said, 1967.
And they're in the possession of the LDS Church now?
I believe so, yes. I believe the Metropolitan did give them to the LDS Church. They were published by John, I'm not sure how to pronounce his last name. It's G-E-E, so I think it's Gee or G.
Gee.
John G. published a very nice little facsimile of the pieces of papyrus, which are, as I said, not the Book of Abraham. They are one of the Egyptian Book of the Dead.
Yeah. Well, this is, again, gets you into this sort of this controversy, because these facsimiles, I think there are three of them that appear in Mormon scripture, do they not?
Yes. Facsimile number 1, 2, and 3. Facsimile number 2 is the one that's a hippocampus that goes under the head. Hippocampus, I'm sorry. That goes under the head.
Right.
Again, we don't have the originals of 1 and 3, and so we don't know what they looked like other than the drawings that were made. The drawing of facsimile number 2 is fairly accurate.
I wonder, one of the things that was interesting is you talked about how, I guess Chandler also would exhibit these mummies to Masonic temples, in Masonic temples. What's the connection between these, you know, pagan Egyptian symbols and concepts and the Christians of the 19th century? What was the connection there?
Well, it's wrapped up in mysticism. Mysticism's long been a very large part of Christianity, right back from the beginning of Christianity. Mystics were considered to be particularly holy on a particularly good level with God. The early church was quite liberal in adopting or adapting other religions to fit into Christianity in order to draw in converts. One of the biggest was the concept of Isis, who was the wife of a resurrected god and the mother of a god who became a king in heaven, with Mary, the mother of a resurrected god and a god who became king in heaven, and they both have immaculate conceptions. They tried to assimilate the symbols of these earlier cultures into Christianity in order to make the pagan community more receptive to Christianity as a religion. One of the most familiar symbols that I think everyone associates with ancient Egypt is the looped cross, the ankh. Mm-hmm. That was adopted by the early church, and it's referred to as the crux ansata. That became a Masonic symbol. The other Masonic symbol is the all-seeing eye of God. That's a direct reference to the Wajet eye of Horus, the all-seeing eye of the sky god.
Mm.
So these mystical concepts were carried forward through the Byzantine church, through the Coptic church, through the Templars, the Crusades. The Templars gave birth, sort of, to the Freemason movement. And then we nowadays have other mystical things, including the Rosicrucians out in California, who are very into this whole mystic connection with God, and that they use these symbols as connectors to God.
Do you still see this kind of element in modern-day Christianity? Are these relics, these ideas?
Yes, I think you do. We still use the cross. I think that Christianity developed by absorbing pagan ideas into itself in order to make it more attractive. And I don't think they ever purged those sorts of things out of Christianity. I think if you go back and you look at any religion, you find this.
So let me ask you this finally. You're finding a lot of these really intriguing kinds of stories. There are a lot of great stories, it seems, connected to mummies. Must be fun.
It is. It started out just, I wanted to know more about one particular mummy that I had been familiar with, Patty Hersheff, and I realized that no one had ever written down the stories. Nobody knew the history of the artifact, and Heather Girl Ferkering, when we talked before, kind of took me to task for calling them artifacts, because they are human beings, and they did have lives. But what people have studied up until my book has been what their lives were in Egypt, not what they were when they came to America. And by looking at literally thousands of newspaper, periodical, serial, book, stories, and histories, and talking to museum curators, I pieced together these amazing histories of these objects. And I think a lot of modern Egypt scholars were a little bit horrified to find how badly the mummies had been treated in the 19th century.
S.J. Wolfe, her book is called Mummies in the 19th Century. The exhibit Mummies of the World continues at the Leonardo until May 27th. To learn more, just go to our website, radiowest.kuer.org. She joined us from a studio in Watertown, Massachusetts. S.J. Wolfe, thank you very much for the time.
Thank you again for having me. It's been most enjoyable.
Radio West is a production of KUER News. Our theme music, composed by The Moth and the Flame. Our thanks to Taylor Almond. We have technical direction from Mike Anderson. The program is produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.